Hello, and welcome to this episode of Explore Cell Therapy. In this podcast, we explore practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies through conversations with transplant centers and hematology oncology practices. I'm Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. For this episode, I sat down with Dr. Fred Applebaum of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center and Dr. Courtney Belomo of New York Oncology Hematology to discuss the evolution of transplant over time. We explore how clinical practice is constantly changing in this rapidly evolving field, and how transplant centers and hematology oncology practices can work together to close gaps in provider understanding that ultimately lead to gaps in patient access to potentially life-saving treatment options. To read their full bios and access additional resources related to today's episode, follow the link in the episode description. This is part one of a three-part discussion. So I am thrilled to welcome Dr. Applebaum and Dr. Belomo today. Thank you both so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
Pleasure.
Wonderful. So we're talking today about the evolution of hematopoietic stem cell transplantation. And so it seems logical to start at the beginning, especially since we have Dr. Applebaum, who had front row seats to the beginning and worked right alongside E. Donnell Thomas, who won the Nobel Prize for his contributions to the field. So starting with you, Dr. Applebaum, can you just tell me a little bit about what transplant was like when you first started training and practicing?
Sure, Sam. I'm old. You got to understand that. And it was a long time ago. I started at the National Cancer Institute. I'd read Don's first attempts at transplantation. There was an article in Blood in 1970, and it just captivated me. I can't exactly explain why. It was partly I enjoyed taking care of critically ill patients. I enjoyed the mystery of transplantation, since so much was unknown about it at the time. And I also could see, at least as Dot explained it, the potential that here was a therapy that was possibly curative for every hematologic disease, whether it be aplastic anemia or sickle cell anemia or leukemia. And so it was partly the impact, partly the drama, partly the mystery of it, but I just was fascinated by it. And so I went to the NCI to start my fellowship in 1974. And it was just at the very beginning of transplantation. At that time, there were just a handful of survivors of twin transplants, and very, very few survivors of allogeneic transplantation. Autologous transplantation hadn't been invented yet, by the way. In fact, when I was at the NCI, I was the first author of the very first paper that showed that you could do autologous transplants. That was in 1977, and that was in patients with Burkitt's lymphoma, which were the very first successful autotransplants. When I got to the Seattle in 1978, just to give you a flavor of what transplantation was like then, we would only do patients who had identical twins or matched siblings. There had never been a successful unrelated donor transplant done. We would only do patients who were under age 40. We felt that patients over age 40 couldn't possibly tolerate the toxicities of the procedure. And when we started a transplant in a patient, we realized that the chance that they could die, not of their leukemia, but of the transplant itself, was approaching 50%. And so that's where transplantation was in the mid to late 70s. And obviously, as Courtney can attest, things have changed a lot since then.
So can you talk about a little bit how much was transplant-related mortality in that first 30 days due to infection versus were you seeing a lot of graft versus host disease? Because, like, or did patients not even make it that far? Because it was so rare that they survived.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Courtney. Early on, we went to extraordinary lengths to try and support our patients during the early pancytopenic period. Patients were housed in laminar airflow rooms. They had to stay in the LAF room for 50 days. The food they ate was all sterile. It had to be radiated. Turns out you can radiate apples and oranges and they taste fine. But if you radiate things that have fat, like fatty cheese, it gets oxidized and turns rancid. So we had to taste test everything we gave our patients. Patients were on prophylactic antibiotics. We were giving prophylactic granulocyte transfusions from their donors. We had invented the Hickman catheter, so we could feed them. And the early mortality from infection during the first month actually was pretty low. We had tackled that problem. But what we hadn't tackled were the subsequent infections. So CMV, there was no therapy for CMV. 25% of our patients became CMV excretors, and half of them died of CMV disease. There was a 7% mortality from pneumocystis. Fungal diseases. If a patient got a fungal infection, it was essentially all over. All we had was amphotericin, or as the nurses called it, shake and bake. Amphotericin. And the only drug we had to treat or protect against graft-versus-host disease was single-agent methotrexate. That was the GVHD prophylaxis. So the mortality rate was probably, the non-relapse mortality rate was mostly infectious from fungal and viral diseases and graft-versus-host disease. And then, again, we were only using very high-dose preparative regimens, and so there was still a substantial incidence of interstitial pneumonia, which was killing 7 to 8% of our patients, and veno-occlusive disease of the liver. So those were the toxicities. We'd gotten through that early bacterial infection phase, but until engraftment. So patients were engrafting, they were making it there, but then it was these other constellation of factors. Thank God we have had such great teamwork with our infectious disease experts who taught us how to prevent CMV, taught us how to prevent pneumocystis, have developed great antifungal therapies. We brought in cyclosporin to decrease graft-versus-host disease and have modulated the preparative regimens so that now we rarely see VOD, which used to be a real problem.
No, yeah, absolutely. It's mind-boggling to me to hear stories of what it was like back then as someone who, you know, we're seeing it in the 2010, 2012 range of trying, you know, at that point, I think we were figuring out why did only one cord take, because we were all the way down to cords. We weren't talking about, we were never transplanting twins. We were really, I think it was at that time that the papers, and maybe that it was a little after that, but that we were learning that, no, you can do a MUD versus a related, and they actually can be pretty similar. Not about, I imagine, some people experiencing for the first time what a sclerodermatous skin changes were, and is that graft versus host disease? And we know we have this thing, but how do we define it? And it's just mind-boggling to see how far we've come and how, as a community provider, I can manage sometimes mild grade one graft versus host disease outside of a transplant center, because I don't think that, obviously with guidance and always this collaborative team, but I don't think that there would have been any possibility of that back then.
Well, I have to say that our community providers were so important for us early on. They were the ones that were referring the patients to us at the appropriate time. And like you say, Courtney, we were sending patients back to community providers who had never seen graft versus host disease. And so we had to be on the phone with our community providers weekly or more often to guide them, because the patients can't stay in Seattle for the rest of their lives. You know, they have to get on with things. And so developing a partnership with our community providers has been really, really important. We've now performed we're probably around over 18,000 transplants here. And we actually know and have follow-up data on 97% of them. So we know where more than 97% of them are. Now, we do that because we have a long-term follow-up office. And that long-term follow-up office has developed, you know, terrific relationships with our community providers. And so, and this is before the days of telemedicine. This is when, you know, you used fax machines. Remember those? You would send Polaroid pictures of the rash. Remember Polaroid?
I do.
And that's how we would communicate back and forth with the community providers who were very, you know, very attentive, very patient, sending in the data to us. I mean, they really had to go above and beyond to care for these patients. And I take my hat off to them.
Well, I will also say, though, on the flip side, as a community provider, they also had guidance from your long-term office about exactly what you needed. And so I think sometimes when we hear, no, you need to give us data on X, Y, and Z once a year, it reminds us what the X, Y, and Z should be for every visit the rest of the year. So having that kind of open communication makes such a difference. You know, we've been talking on another panel that I've been on with the NMDP about how communication is everything. That anyone can manage anything if you have the right support net and can tap into the specialist. But if you don't have a way to have that dialogue, it all falls apart. And then I think frequently it's the patient who's left in the middle trying to advocate for themselves. While I certainly wholeheartedly support patients advocating for themselves and being informed, in an ideal world, we would have this whole kind of bubble wrap around them that they wouldn't have to figure that out.
Absolutely. I agree entirely with that, for sure. Yeah.
No, 100%. And that's an area where the NMDP is really trying to help as much as we can to bridge that gap between community practices and transplant centers as much as possible. Whether it be through our HLA Today program or other, you know, initiatives in the future, we want to really try to promote coordinated care, and the communication seems to be the centerpiece of that. Of that process,
it's communication and it's also data. And I think that you know, for the Hutch, for example, we've been able to keep because we have this great follow up. We have very detailed information about our patients over the years. We recently published a paper in Annals, which was a follow up to a earlier New England Journal paper, where we looked at around 1,500 patients that we transplanted between 1993 and 1997, and compared them to another 1,500 we transplanted between 2003 and 2007, with another over 1,000 patients we transplanted between 2013 and 2017. So we have these three time posts, each a decade apart. The non-relapse mortality back in 93 to 97 was about 30%. 2003 to 2007, it was halved to about 15%. And 2013 to 2017, it was almost halved again. So it was less than 10%. And we can see where the advances have been made. And they are made in less fungal disease and less viral disease and less graft versus host disease. The NMDP and also the CIBMTR is another incredibly rich source of information where we can look at the outcomes of large numbers of patients, and we can find both what's expected, we can find where the problems are, and how we should be attacking those problems. And it's data is so incredibly valuable in understanding the problems and trying to attack them.
And I think what's so interesting about that point also is I think knowing that data and having it out there becomes so important to the conversation that you have with your community providers. Because I think you may have a provider in the community that trained in the 90s, and that's still what transplant is to them, versus being able to see the data and say, look how far we've come. Especially I'm a dedicated hematologist now, but I can't imagine the general oncologist out there trying to sift through all of the molecular changes. Their job is incredibly hard. And so if you see only a few people who need a transplant a year, and all you actually get back are those patients who don't do well because they relapse, I think it doesn't change the paradigm in your head about how far we've really come. And we, one of the trials that we're participating in right now at our site is with Dana-Farber, where they've looked at a bunch of community practices and this really shared care model. So what does it look like if, you know, even day 14 post-transplant, you're going back to your community provider, and for 1 week and the following week, you're seeing us, and we're comparing those people who were randomized to standard of care, so everything at the transplant center versus standard of care. That data is probably not going to be out till the end of this year. But I was actually on a meeting earlier this morning where we were talking about, you know, what if it shows that shared care isn't better? And I brought up the point, well, maybe it's not that shared care isn't better. Maybe it's that we haven't figured out how to do it right. Because inherently, people like their own beds. They like their community. It gives them better support systems. And we know in other places that that gives better outcomes. So how do we collect this data to show those who don't dip their foot in the transplant pool that often because they don't have that many patients? How do we show that you actually can do it with the right education and the right support, and that what you remember from fellowship in the 90s is not what it is now in the 2020s?
Yeah, those are great points, Courtney. You know, when you look at the transplant needs to get better for sure, but it also has to become more accessible. Right now, it's a bad thing to paraphrase, but you know, it's kind of like Woody Allen said about life. It's tough and it's too short. Well, transplantation is tough and it's not accessible enough. When we look at the barriers to transplantation, obviously, one of them is financial. But it's also where you happen to live. Patients who live in rural communities don't get transplanted as often as patients that live in more urban areas. And so how we can extend this life-saving therapy to benefit all of the patients in need is really important.
And I think so much of that is not just, it's about all the intangibles that you don't see and that we don't really talk about as providers. So it's not only that they have to travel how many hours to get to a transplant center, but it's also the financial toxicity of potentially leaving a business that they own for a month or 3 months or a year, depending on what it looks like. It's the, who's going to take, you know, how young are you? Who's going to take care of the kids at home? Or not a world that I'm familiar with, but the pediatric allogeneic transplants where you're literally taking one kid to get one thing and another parent is left with other kids. And so it's all those little toxicities that we forget about. And I find that, I mean, there's so many things obviously that are awful about the pandemic, but I think one of the silver linings is pushing us to do telehealth and pushing our community to figure out how to reach people that have been unreachable up to this point. Cancer care, whether it be transplant or not, should be accessible to all. Healthcare should be accessible to all. And so how do we take those people in the rural communities with a community doc and allow telehealth to help guide, allow the education of the provider to guide, so that when they come to a place like Seattle, they're there for a short amount of time, and this is what that financial toxicity looks like, rather than, hey, you may be, we have some of our transplant centers where we tell them you may be down there for 100 days. Well, with people with young kids, how do you just leave for 100 days? It's not a realistic expectation that we have. So agreed that it does need to be more accessible to everyone, because I think sometimes the conversation as the provider sitting in front of them, as the community provider, when they say, "Doc, what you're describing, I can't do," we then take transplant off the table. And it shouldn't be that simple a conversation.
I couldn't agree with you more, Courtney. And it's not just the patient. At most transplant centers, you have to have a caregiver.
Right.
Because we do so much of this in the outpatient department. So you have to have a way to get back and forth to the clinic. You have to have someone that's monitoring your medicines. It doesn't have to be a medically trained person. You have to have someone that is looking after the Hickman catheter. And so not only do you need the patient to be there, but you need a caregiver. And that, again, adds to the complexity of it and adds a real burden as well. And I particularly when we start transplanting patients who are in their 60s and 70s, it's a lot to imagine the spouse or partner or whoever it is to take on all of that responsibility. But that's what we ask of our patients and their families.
And I think it also, too, is we forget that that amount of burden also means, like, what does that mean for a family unit? Even if your kids are grown and there are grandkids, like, what does that mean if stressing, you know, we're taking mom for transplant, but we're stressing dad, and then dad ends up with health conditions, and then a whole family unit is left with a new paradigm that they didn't have before? Because I think that we forget sometimes as providers how to make the concept of cure accessible. It's what everybody wants. So lots of people, eye on the prize, right? Let's get it done. Let's figure it out. But not really having a full understanding about what cure really means and what that can mean to your life. And yes, we've gotten a lot better about treating the complications and treating the disease. But have we gotten to a point where transplant's the right choice for everyone just because it can be? I don't know that that's actually true.
No, that's a really great point. And speaking a little bit about the access piece, so we're talking a lot about the psychosocial barriers to transplant and, you know, economic barriers, things like that. But let's talk a little bit about some of the advances that you've both seen in terms of improving access around, say, donor criteria or even just overall patient eligibility for transplant. Because, you know, the psychosocial barriers come with their own set of challenges, as we know. But, you know, you mentioned age, Dr. Applebaum, like thinking of transplanting someone in their 60s or 70s. We know that wasn't even an option before. So can you speak a little bit to those advances?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I think all the things that Courtney was talking about are absolutely true about the barriers, psychosocial, financial, et cetera. But you can't even talk about those unless transplantation is even a possibility. We have at least the luxury, if you want to call it that, of being able to have those discussions now where we didn't have that luxury in the past. And the two things that have changed the accessibility of transplantation the most are donor availability and age, for sure. When I started transplanting patients, as I mentioned, we limited it to patients who were age 40 or less. Our view was that if you had a healthy Marine who was 45 years old, it was unlikely that they could survive a transplant. But with the development of preparative regimens that are less intensive, with the development of better supportive care, we gradually increased the age from 40, and then we went up to 50. And then as some of the transplanters got a little older, we increased it to age 55, as we started to be 55 ourselves, and then it hit 60. Now we are transplanting patients who are in their 70s. Not every patient, it's not appropriate for every patient for sure, but we are carrying out allogeneic transplants in patients who are in their 70s. We use very low intensive preparative regimens and rely predominantly on the graft versus leukemia effect. And these transplants, by and large, are performed in the outpatient department. About 50% of the patients end up being hospitalized at some point because of infections or fluid needs, et cetera. But about half of them stay out entirely throughout the entire transplant procedure. So that's been one huge difference. And again, that's one of the things that I'm not sure that has filtered out into the community. We're gradually seeing more AML patients in their 70s starting to be transplanted. 20 years ago, it was virtually nil. Then last in the decades of the 2000s, 2000 to 2010, there were maybe 150 patients over age 70 with AML transplanted throughout the United States. The next decade, it went up to over 300, and it continues to rise.
So I'm curious about your thoughts, because I think that there's kind of almost two groups of people when you talk about transplanting the elderly. There are two groups of people who are going to make referrals. There are those who are your community oncologists who are not necessarily leukemia specialists, who are going to see your MDS, MF, and your myelodysplasia, your myelofibrosis, things like that. But then there's also the leukemia centers who induce their own leukemics, but don't necessarily do transplant. And as someone who kind of wears that hat in my practice with some others, I'm curious about your thought, given the emerging regimens, especially venetoclax, of the role of needing to induce these people into remission versus giving them something like decitabine venetoclax. And in someone over the age of 70, is induction a good litmus test for how these people are going to do? Because I think sometimes we are really stuck with the idea of, yeah, let's give them 7+3, but maybe with a reduced intensity conditioning, if you had gotten them into remission with decitabine venetoclax, we would have had a different paradigm of how they did. So I'm just curious about, I'm sure Courtney, you see a lot
Courtney,
of that.
Courtney.
I know, sorry. It's not really a fair question, is it?
No, it's an absolutely fair question because it's one that we are struggling with nationally. In fact, it's going to be the subject of a national trial. We need to do 7+3 versus azacitidine venetoclax. That combination has really taken the country by storm. It's really easy to give, and the results are pretty good. But if you look at the number of CRs that are free of MRD, they're not very many. The minimal residual disease CRs are pretty low, probably in the range of maybe 15%. With a combination. And that is a problem if you're going to go on to a transplant, yeah, because we know if you enter a transplant with MRD, the likelihood of cure is probably less than if you're MRD free. So it's a great question, but unfortunately, not one that we can easily answer right now. If you get into a CR that's MRD free, at least our data suggests that it doesn't matter how you got there once you get there.
Yeah.
So there's no advantage to intensive chemotherapy induced MRD free CRs compared to venetoclax azacitidine induced MRD negative CRs once you get there. But the question is, do you get there?
Get there.
And that's a great question that you're addressing that we don't have the answer
to. No, and I'm glad to hear that there's going to be a trial about that, because I think that one of the things that I think gives a community oncologist pause about a referral to a transplant center in someone over the age of 70 is functional status. So I think that we see after that 7+3, lots of people being very beat up and not necessarily. And I think also too is at smaller centers such as ours, we get where you guys probably get it more in real time. We get a lot of our genetic and molecular studies and our next generation sequencing back 2 weeks later. So to say, 2 weeks in, I now have a 17P and I should be, of course, using a hypomethylating agent we're getting all that data later. And so we're finding that we're transitioning people when they don't necessarily respond from 7+3 to Vyxeos to a hypomethylating based regimen with venetoclax. And so it does, I think, pose the question of how much did we lose with those 2 weeks of that person being in a bed and super sick? And what does that mean for transplant? But yes, time and time again, agree with you. Data shows if you're not an MRD, it doesn't really matter.
And that's interesting. So in terms of MRD status and the timing of referral from a hematology oncology practice to a transplant center, would you say that, Dr. Bellumo, do you tend to wait for MRD negative status to refer, or is that something that you should refer anyway and then sort of wait and see what happens?
We are big in at least our area of refer, refer, refer. Earlier, the better. And I think that, you know, we utilize HLA today so our patients who come in for induction, they are getting swabbed. We use HLA family to get their families swabbed and open up the conversation about transplant right all during that induction. And when they are discharged 4 to 6 weeks later, in that 2 week of discharge, they will see typically the transplant specialist at the referral center plus a second opinion leukemia specialist. So we have kind of that added blanket. If the things we are planning do not work, then we've got that other specialist involved during those 2 weeks before they come back into the hospital for their consolidation. But I think it still takes 8 to 12 weeks to find a donor. Still, like, even though we have, and maybe Dr. Applebaum, you would disagree with that, but even with looking for donors and the right donors and doing that search, it's at least 8 weeks. So I don't think waiting for MRD negativity, the worst that happens is they've met someone that we never end up using, rather than, oh, you're MRD negative, and now I have to kind of, bite all my nails off, hoping that you stay that way until you get to transplant, rather than it being seamless and ready to go. Because I think not only does it do the patient a disservice doing it later from a medical standpoint, I think it also does them a disservice from all of those other psychosocial issues. People like to plan. Having cancer is already a huge loss of control. So as much as we can give that back to them, that is in their best interest.
I think Courtney is exactly right. And I think that's a really reasonable plan, that the way that they do it. I think that makes great sense. And that's what we would suggest. And that's how we do it as well. Very similar.
So given that I heard once, and maybe this isn't true, but I heard once that the Hutch, UCSF, and City of Hope goes as like the West Coast Mafia of transplant, which I found to be a hilarious analogy. But given that you guys, I imagine that people come from all over the country to come and get transplanted at Seattle. How do you work those referrals when they are coming, let's say, from like North Carolina or, you know, France or a totally different country around the world? How do you guys utilize a lot of telehealth, or do they need to show up in person because that visual litmus test is important?
I think the comment you made earlier about the pandemic changing practice is absolutely true. We now are doing many, many more consults by telehealth than we did in the past. Unfortunately, and I have to confess that I'm probably not up to date, but as of at least a year ago, in 49 out of the 50 states, you had to be licensed in the state where the patient was in order to see them and charge for a telehealth visit. Now, those restrictions were temporarily lifted in some states, and I don't know how many, but I do know I did a consult just a couple weeks ago where the poor patient was from Washington, D.C., and I got licensed temporarily in West Virginia, and the patient drove his car across the West Virginia border, and we did the telehealth conference while he's sitting in his car right over the West Virginia border, so it could be legal, wow. legitimate, which is insane. I mean, it's absurd. But we do an awful lot of our consults by telehealth now. I would say that I probably do at least half of mine by telehealth. So we don't demand that they come here personally. I think that seeing the patient in the flesh is probably a little better, but I think we're learning a lot. We know the kinds of questions to ask by telehealth. I think we're all getting better at it.
Yeah, no, we definitely are seeing that paradigm here as well, that Massachusetts has the law that you have to be licensed in that state, but New York does not, I don't know if it doesn't or if it's still, you know, that restriction is still lifted, yeah. but we're allowed to see anyone because we have a lot of snowboards. I'm sure you guys probably have the same kind of paradigm yeah. out on the West Coast, but that I see a ton of people on telehealth in Florida. Because I do think that one of the specialties where it really lends itself to doing telehealth is hematology. Because what you need is their labs. I don't need their heart or their lungs for a lot of heme. Obviously, that's different when you're talking about a transplant patient. But
thanks so much for listening. It's been such a great discussion so far. Join us next time on Explore Cell Therapy for part 2.